Welcome to the Exalt Podcast. My name is Christopher Shagnon.
And I'm Sophia Hagolani-Elba.
Today we're joined by Gutu Wayessa. He's a university lecturer in development studies at the University of Helsinki.
I'm really glad that he's able to join us today because he's going to be adding a new dimension to the conversations that we've had so far on the podcast. We're going to get to explore some topics that we haven't really broached directly yet. So I think that this will be really interesting in helping to flesh out some of the research and ideas that can happen under the umbrella of the Exalt Initiative.
Yeah, we're going to be talking a lot about land today, which of course, as is famously said, it's the foundation of everything. But it's something we haven't really had a chance to talk about yet, but it does have such major impacts on food systems, on societies, on extractivisms and alternatives.
Definitely. So we're really looking forward to getting into this discussion about land and livelihoods. Without further ado, Gutu, hello, welcome.
Thank you, Sophia and Chris. I'm pleased to be here. My name is Gutu Wayessa, or Gutu Olana Wayessa. That is the way we pronounce the full name. To introduce myself, as Chris introduced me, I'm currently a university lecturer in development studies. My research has been mainly on large-scale land deals, of a great interest, a lot of interest in environmental justice, land governance issues, displacement, resettlement, and also recently social movement and scholarly activism. I am about to start a new research project that is going to be funded by Kone Foundation, which still deals with the same similar issues, expanding a bit my previous research, large-scale land deals and local livelihoods in Ethiopia, a political ecology of a contested scheme.
Wonderful. So how did you get interested in these topics?
Yes. Now, this takes me back to the historical and contemporary significance of land as a resource in Ethiopia. Probably that is true for many communities, many countries. But for me, actually, land has been one of probably few questions that have shaped the political economy of the country for many years. If I have to talk a little bit of history for the last 50 years, two questions were prominent. Big questions of nationality and land have shaped the political struggle. And also, that is, in a way, what interested me to deal with this land question. And also that speaks to my PhD research, which is about resettlement and displacement, whereby the state moved people from one place to another place within the country. Then I looked at also the livelihood implications of these mobilities or government-sponsored movement from place to place. Though at the same time, if you remember 2007, 2008, associated with the rise in price of food commodities and associated significance of land, which actually grew in magnitude and pace significantly, I got interested to propose a project in land lease, particularly large-scale land deals, whereby foreign companies and domestic companies are engaged in leasing land from the government. Exactly, actually, that is what happens in Ethiopia, because government owns, in practice, the land. And it leases land. Land is actually, in principle, not sold or exchanged. It's not a private property. It is the constitution states that the land belongs to the state and the people, but the people is actually nominal in many contexts when you look at how it is done in practice. So I was interested to see what would it mean for the people who are using the land when it comes to these large-scale land deals, given the pace and given the authoritarian nature of the state, whereby the voice of the people is not respected, where customary right to land is not really respected. And we can talk actually when we delve into the issues, but those are primarily the reasons that actually attracted me to deal with this topic.
No, it's absolutely fascinating. And there's so much popping into my head right now about the ways this can play out, because there are so many different ethnic groups in Ethiopia. And I'm really curious how this sort of large-scale land leasing plays out. Are there particular groups that have their like traditional lands like being leased more, or are there particular areas of the country that are more prone towards these land leases?
Give us the lay of the land.
Yeah, interesting in a way, because actually those questions of nationality, ethno-national identity, and the question of land has got historical background, but they were questions on their own, important political economic questions on their own, but also in an interesting way, they do interact. The way Chris actually put it, actually seeks actually the interaction between how they play out. Let me give a very brief introduction of the current administrative structure of Ethiopia. In 1991, the current government, which actually only recently changed it, the ruling party's name, came into power with the name EPRDF, Ethiopian People's Democratic Revolutionary Front, a coalition of four parties. And in 1991, before that, the Derg government, which is considered to be military socialist government, was in power. But after a very protracted civil war, the government that came into power in 1991, they actually made a coalition of parties in transition to what was supposed to be multinational federal arrangement. Prior to that, the country was divided into different provinces. Probably, okay, yes, of course, some ethnic groups fall within certain provinces in large number. But it's only since the constitution that was written in 1994 and enacted in 1995 that regional states, primarily based on ethno-national and linguistic identity, but also there are other criteria for constituting the federation, regional states were formed and through this constitution, and there were 9 regional states and 2 city administrations. Until recently, and only last week, another regional state was added to this, also as a result of growing question of self-governance by certain national groups. And of course, this is a very, very current issue that is going on, and demands for statehood within the federal arrangement is growing at the moment. And of course, there are also forces that are opposing those kinds of moves. So in principle, the country is a multinational federation whereby people are supposed to govern themselves at the level of regional states and share proper representation in the federal arrangement. So yes, some regions do have larger size of farmlands compared to others. For example, some lowland areas which are sparsely populated, even if the land is actually under use, certain types of use are not recognized by the state. And in fact, in most cases, the government claims to lease the lands that are empty or underutilized, which is not always the case. In fact, in most cases, especially the cases that I have stated, this has not been the case. That what is common is rather the lands are under alternative uses, which are not necessarily recognized by the state, or probably the people may not have legal right or registered right to the land, but they are using customarily. In fact, that customary utilization of land is also, in principle, recognized by the constitution, because it says the people have the right not to be evicted from their land on whatever ground. But what happens in practice is different. So yes, in some regions, if you look at, for example, Oromia Regional State, which is the regional state where I focus in terms of the field work, the practical data, It is very large in terms of population, in terms of size. The biggest state is Oromia Regional State, but also smaller regions, but pastoral areas, for example, like the Gambela Regional State, or areas where shifting cultivation is practiced. Those are actually leased to a large extent as well. The southern part is pretty much affected by this land lease compared to the northern part. And that is also an interesting angle to look why that happens. Going back to history, the feudal times, whereby land was actually under the control of landlords, whereby people were divided into landlords and tenants. That is actually what brought about the 1974 revolution, primarily.
So I have a question. When you say feudal times, I know that what jumps to my head is like the European version of feudal times, but what time period are you actually talking about in the Ethiopian context?
I'm actually talking about a very recent history in that sense. The Ethiopian state actually was formed in its current, in its modern state, encompassing the current territory, except that Eritrea actually became independent in 1993. It's quite recent, but actually the feudal system, whereby you have landlords who own the land in big, big size, and tenants who are working for the landlords or share a great deal of their produce to the landlords, it has been happening until 1974. Let me just talk about the regime that precedes that time. I don't know if you're aware of this name. Emperor Haile Selassie ruled the country from 1930 to 1974. The revolution that took place in 1974 ousted the emperor from power. Actually, in that incident, he was also killed. So before that, the land was owned by a small number of people, while the majority had been working for the landlords. So the land question has been important also because of that. It is one of the most important questions that ignited the revolution itself in 1974. And in 1975, out of recognition of that question, the government actually declared a proclamation called Land to the Tiller. Thereby, every individual was actually provided with access to land, at least at the level of the right to use the land, even if not to own or to transact or to hold it in private as a private property. So that in 1991, the new government that came into power under the leadership of EPRDF also maintained that policy of land as a property of the state and the people, in principle at least, but pretty much controlled the power to do whatever it wants to do with land. So that is the feudal system I was talking about, belongs to a very recent history of probably 45 years ago, 45, 46 before that.
Thank you so much for sharing some of the context with us. I think it's always so important when we are talking about these things in different areas of the world to make sure that we take into account some of the contextualization of the actual place. Because I know that, at least for myself, sometimes it's very easy, you know, you hear certain words and it's easy to make assumptions like, oh, feudal, he must be talking about something that, you know, happened a really long time ago. But it's really interesting to hear this very specific context for looking at the land and what it means and how it's passed through different hands even very, very recently.
Yeah, I think that this context is so important. And especially looking at, I mean, how this is evolving today, I'm really curious about who are these people or companies or actors that are leasing this land and engaging in these land leases?
Thank you. Again, a little bit of context before I just directly go to this question, Chris. And that is, over the last 15 years or so, the Ethiopian state actually tried to profile itself as developmental state. And that actually meant a lot of engagement or using every possibility of attracting investment from foreign companies, foreign states as well. So the actors are obviously states, because this is large scale transnational land deals, and actually powerful companies. If I give you the examples of the companies I dealt with in my research, which was recently published, Karuturi is one of the companies. It is an Indian company. And in that specific case, we may come to that later, but it leased 11,700 hectares from the state. But also, this is actually very small compared to other land leases that have been taking place in the country. Hundreds of hectares are leased out to foreign companies. And most of them come actually from Middle East countries and the Gulf states, for example, China, India. And of course, the Western countries were already there. But the recent developments show that more and more involvement is taking place actually by the investors from countries or areas like Gulf states and countries in such as India and China. So Karuturi itself is an Indian company. In Gambela, the region I just mentioned to you toward the introduction, Saudi Star, which is actually Saudi-related company, leased hundreds of hectares of land from a region. So the actors are transnational, but also it should be recognized that there are small scale relative to this size of land, but domestic investors as well. And in that paper, which was recently published, I also include a domestic company called Jacaranda as a study. These Karuturi and Jacaranda were close to each other when I visited the area. And so let's put it this way. The actors, the state actually is a powerful actor in this, in attracting foreign companies, in probably availing resources at a cheap price in the interest of attracting capital for the kind of development it wants to actually push forward. And that happens in a context of self-profiling as a developmental state, and in fact, in a context of competition from other countries, but also in the context of forcing conditions that are forcing certain countries to look for land in other countries and regions.
Thank you for giving us such a good summary there. Now, when these transnational companies are leasing this land, what are they actually doing with the land that they lease? Like, what's then happening with the land? Are they developing it? Are they doing agriculture on it? What's the, I don't know if this is too broad a question, but what's the motivation of these actors for coming in and leasing the land?
Generally speaking, there are a number of motivations, but the focus, especially the primary data for my research, comes with from cases whereby companies lease land from the government for agricultural investment purposes, like plantations, like growing crops. What is interesting is, in fact, the companies don't do what they promise to do sometimes. And that is particularly true with the cases that I studied. Yes, in different places, there are, for example, these economic zones for the purpose of industrialization in cities, for the purpose of building factories. Land leases do happen, but my study has focused so far on land leases for the purpose of growing crops or different types of plantations that may include biofuels that I didn't study myself, but also there are flower companies that lease land from the government with diverse implications that are worthy studying, actually.
Now, just a really quick question, following up on the agricultural aspect of it. Have you found that when these companies are coming in and leasing the land, are they growing crops in a way that's appropriate for the actual land, or is it bringing in industrial agricultural models to the land?
Especially these large-scale land deals actually involve commercial firms, which are particularly business-oriented. In fact, there are interesting details that I can give you in relation to the cases that I studied. This company, Karuturi, the Indian company I just mentioned, leased this land, 11,700 hectares, to grow oil palm. But I was told by the people they never grew that plantation, that oil palm. Immediately, they started growing maize or corn, that land. And the people and the local people actually objected to this because the people knew that the soil is not good for growing maize or corn. There is a lot of water lodging in that area. But the company actually said they would drain the area, the land, and they did it because they have the machinery and everything. That area is a lowland area people were using for grazing their livestock, and they also producing certain types of crops. There were two types of crops that the people told me the land was suitable for. One is they call nugi locally, which is Niger seed. The other one is teff or taffy, according to the local language. Beyond that, they used it for livestock grazing. This company came in and they started to grow maize despite their original plan to produce palm oil. In fact, the way the company came in is also interesting to talk about, but I may come back to that later. Then the people objected. Actually, they expressed to the company, this Indian company, that the land is not suitable for this type of crop, but the company didn't listen to the people. They tried to produce some for some number of years, but there has never been good relationship with the local people. They never succeeded actually in producing well, even for their own profit. And the land that was leased out to them in 2008-2009, they tried only for 5 years, 5-6 years, and they stopped producing everything in 2014-2015. This is true for Karuturi, but also true for Jacaranda. They both started operation the same year, 2008-2009, and stopped operation 2014-2015. So this is monocropping most of the time, but what they do is that they grow one type of crop on a huge plot of land. And to do that, they actually cleared a lot of trees from the land. I saw the place only after they left, so it is cleared. But the people tell me that it was forest land. They used to use it for different purposes, for even producing honey. They could not do it anymore. If the area is to regenerate, it would take a number of years to come to that state. So some of the damages that were done to the environment are significant, and the people are very disappointed. You can see how painful it was for them to experience the eradication of the trees. So the projects or the research project that I have been dealing with has to do with agricultural investment. And most of the time, the large scale, intensive agriculture based on chemicals and large machineries.
Wow. To me, that sounds very close to what I would term an agro-extractivism. I know extractivism as a term originally came up around natural resources, like, for example, mining, like literal mining of resources out of the ground. But it sounds like a lot of the externalities and implications of these companies coming in and starting these land projects that are what sounds like really devastating the local landscape are extractivist in their own right, because they're creating environments that no longer match with what the lived environment was in the area. So that sounds completely devastating, especially with what you said, that, you know, they came in, they destroyed what was there in terms of the land, and then tried to grow something that was inappropriate, which I'm sure had its own environmental implications, and then just left. And I imagine that the lease itself wasn't up in 2014. How long are these land leases generally?
It's very long-term lasers that I'm talking about, especially in the case of Karuturi. I was informed that it was supposed to be for 45 years.
Whoa.
And by the time I was doing field work, they were still claiming the land as they dealt with the government, because the government was not happy with the investment itself somehow. The local government was in conflict with them. The local people were in conflict with them. To understand the context more generally, it is good also to talk about the original promises when they came in. And what the people felt, broken promise, explains part of the failure of these companies in a way, as I see it. You know, the problem, actually, generally speaking, is a very authoritarian state who writes something as a matter of right for the people, as a matter of right of access to land, as a matter of right not to be displaced on any ground. That is explicitly stated. Even these customary rights are supposed to be recognized in some way. But all of a sudden, they came when they were actually looking around which land to lease to foreign companies. The government started to register the land for the local people, only limiting them to the land very close to their home state. Now, the people categorize the land as red soil, which is in their residence place close by. There is a black soil down, a valley, very, very wide one. And that is where the trees and where they were using as a common property for grazing as well as for producing certain types of crops. But then the people started to develop interest also to get those lands, the black soil, to be registered under their name so that they would pay tax for it and use it as legal users. But the government said, no, you have this land, this piece of land, and that is very small, actually, on average, less than 2 hectares. So they were denied. Anyway, then you have been using the land, but now there is a company to which we want to lease the land. But let us talk about it. Now, the people came to these meetings organized by the state, in which the investors were present and enlisted all kinds of promises that would emerge if these investments take place in that area. That included actually of something of national significance, of economic development, flow of capital, and so on, but also specific to the locality, for example, infrastructure development, roads, electricity, water infrastructure, none of which were materialized. The only thing the company did, Karuturi did, was to pave a gravel road to the site of the company itself. That's it. And when it did this, it happened that the trees in front of the homes of those local people were cut down without compensation, even if they had the right to be compensated for their trees, that is, in front of their homes. That didn't happen either. The only person who could sell them at higher level and got compensation was for his mango trees, one person I was told about. The rest actually were asked to sacrifice their property for the construction of the road. So there were a lot of promises for school building, providing water facilities, electricity, and so on. None of those materialized except this gravel road. Beyond that, of course, they were also promised jobs for their children, for their educated, and in fact, so a kind of training, which actually states project as a kind of technology transfer when these kinds of investments take place, that people get educated. The interesting part was that this company was very humble, as if they were willing to learn from the people, learn from each other, and develop the area. But the relationship went problematic quite soon after they started oppression. And as I said, in 5-6 years, it had to stop it completely. Some of the damage, as I said, done to the land are probably not reversible in a relatively short period of time. And the promises were not realized. There are other complications that arose. One of the promises were to provide job opportunity for the local people. What they provided was actually not on regular basis. They could provide job to the local people as laborers, daily laborers, whereby they paid approximately 50 cents when we talk in terms of dollars, 40 to 50 cents. And for daily laborers, for some machine operators, it could be a bit more. So that was because there is no minimum pay in the according to the state's regulation. They could employ at as low as at that level. So if you look at the promises of providing job and providing infrastructure and actually developing together, learning from each other, those promises were completely dashed and people resent that. But all this is related to something called consultation, consulting people before the land is leased out to investors. But that consultation is without any substance. If you talk to the people, they had no say at all as to what would happen to the land. They are actually consulted for the sake of consultation. It is absolutely nominal and has no meaning in terms of what would happen to the land and how would they claim if the promises were not realized. There are no such mechanisms of redressing those kinds of injustice. So these are some of the things that come to my mind. So they were actually essentially told to evacuate from the land, to stop using the land, and cooperate with the investors for their own benefit. And looking back, the people had a lot of resentment.
This is really very, very powerful and interesting to hear about. And there are a few different things popping into my head right now that I'm wondering. I guess the first is, I mean, since you had mentioned you had looked at both international companies, but as well domestic companies, I'm curious if this sort of experience is a more common thing, did you find? And also somewhat tied into that is we've talked a lot about this almost irreparable environmental damage and broken promises. And, you know, something when you were talking about like the forests and, you know, people growing honey and stuff like that, it made me wonder about the sort of cultural devastation that's happened, because I'd imagine it with such a drastic environmental change, it must also really impact traditional industries or food systems. So I'm curious if this is like similar across the board in experiences and also like what kind of cultural impacts it's had.
Interesting question, actually, because this also helps me to explain some of the issues that I have not explained. And in this particular research, what I did was then, okay, the land was leased out. The claim from the government is that the land was not utilized efficiently or not utilized at all. So it is an empty land or underutilized land that we are leasing out. So it is supposed to benefit not just the national economy, but also the local economy. Then my interest was, if that is a claim on the part of the state, what would the people say? What would it mean to them? The comparison of access to land and associated implications before and after the land lease. So that is what I did. And for that reason, I had to look into the prior use of the land. What were the people using the land for? And that came out very clearly, and they were using it for grazing their livestock. That area is actually an area known for considerable number of livestock, and they were devastated in that sense also, because that access to grazing was negatively affected, compromised a lot. The other part is a crop production part, whereby they grew niger seed and teff. So that is the land use in relation to producing products that are important for the livelihood. But beyond that, there are issues of land-based social relations. because that actually relates to Chris' questions of cultural issues and something that goes beyond land as a resource per se. In relation to livestock, the people were practicing something, an institution they call Daraba. They call it Daraba in Oromo language, in Afan Oromo. Daraba means people who do not have access to grazing land, they send away their livestock under the custody of others, other people who are in that area whereby there is availability of grass for grazing in exchange of certain benefits. So that institution is compromised because of this land lease. And you can see, I actually compared the livestock ownership before and after land lease. So the decline is significant, not just in terms of at the level of description, but statistically significant as well, the decline in access in livestock ownership. In relation to crop production, access to land itself, the size of land they used to have before and after is very different. There is a significant decline also in access to farmland because they were actually not allowed to use the land that was leased out, obviously, to the company. And that meant a reduction in the amount of crops they could produce for their livelihoods, also for in exchange for other products by selling it if there is any surplus. Beyond that, in relation to crop production, people who had more land could lease out temporarily certain piece of land to others who need more land but have more labor, for example, who have less access to land, but more labor, they produce and they share the product. Okay, they share the input, they also share the product. And that is actually called sharecropping. Sharecropping in the context of no land to lease to a friend, to other fellow farmer, that also was also compromised a lot. Even very directly to the cultural realm of implication of this land lease is there is a hill which the people in that area called Tulusa'a, which means the hill of cattle. And that hill had many significant role in their lives. They used to get some construction material from that hill. They used to graze their livestock also from the grass that is over there. But in addition to that, they had a spiritual cultural practice that they used to do in that hill. Now, the interesting part would be the hill was not supposed to be part of the concession that was leased out to Karuturi. But after everything had been settled, they used the hill to construct their residence. And I have pictures of that hill, actually. They constructed their residence in that hill. In fact, because the people had resentment with the rest of the land, there was actually physical confrontation between the local people and the company workers at that time. And in fact, the government security force had to intervene. So in another paper, which I'm developing at the moment, I'm thinking of addressing those issues from environmental justice perspective, because these have got a lot of explanation that would be linked to the question of cultural recognition, political representation, and redistribution of resources. So I will bring in this dimension of cultural, spiritual issues that the people considered important but completely neglected by authorities, both the investment company and the state itself.
It sounds like on so many fronts, these land leases are a big kind of bait and switch. You know, the companies make these promises but then aren't following through on them. And it doesn't seem like there's the respect for the actual land uses that fit in with the sociocultural use of the land. Now, just to play devil's advocate, are there any examples that you know of where the land leasing has been positive for the community involved, or would you more characterize it as more negative overall?
That is a fair question. Actually, because these are the cases that I firsthand studied myself. That said, from my reading, because there are similar studies in Ethiopia and beyond that dealt with the implications, livelihood implications of these large-scale land deals, by and large, they are negative, especially in contexts where, by the way, when these lands were leased out, there is no compensation. There has never been any compensation. Even in other countries whereby there are compensations, by and large, it could be said that the experience of the local people is pretty much negative.
So what's a general lesson that people could draw from these cases and these experiences that you've shared with us about these land leasing? I hesitate to say deal because I feel like that has a kind of positive connotation. These land leasing, would scheme be the right word for it?
Deal is also not bad, actually. It tells us quite something about the power relation. The deal, what is interesting is now investment comes in. There are actors that are involved. Now, how many actors, how powerful are they, and what role they play in a certain context could be different from what could happen in another context. But what is common is there are actors with certain role. And the power they amass, the power they have in that process is important. And what is important is also to make a difference, to distinguish between right as stated in black and white, as clearly stated right in constitution or different types of laws, but also right as a matter of exercising it. And actually, a theory of access developed by Jesse Ribot talks about access rights and access ability. The ability to exercise one's right has to do with power also. So now you look at certain laws, certain proclamations, certain documents, they are beautifully written and they give right to the people in unequivocal terms. But the exercise of those rights is different on the ground. Now, this could simply taken as a very simple issue of the discrepancy between policy and practice. But in fact, the practice itself sometimes becomes a policy to be done in that way, to be done at the exclusion of the local people. So not taking it for granted that things happen to take place in the way they are supposed to take place is one lesson. And the details of what changes and what remains to change, if there is any benefit, one or two or three, from one context could be different in another context. But at the end of the day, the overall experience of the people should be understood in terms of the process, the whole process from the very beginning, when the idea of leasing land was introduced, for example, from the very day of they started to register the land in the backyards of their homestead and all the way to the outcome. Now, the process for me is very important also because there should be different processes could take to the same outcome, or the same process could take to different outcomes in different contexts, but the peoples themselves should appraise, should evaluate what their experience is throughout the process and also in terms of outcome. Sometimes when you don't study the place very specifically, when you don't have first-hand information and contact with the people on the local level, it is difficult to make the details of what has changed and what did not change and what benefits or costs they had to share, and how these costs and benefits are redistributed among the different actors. And even within the local people, the dynamics in terms of gender, in terms of different social groups, and so on, in terms of proximity to the land that is leased out, and so on. So the process may unfold in different ways, But that process is very important all the way to the outcome. Also, the outcomes could be different for different land lease cases, but they are important also for the people. To understand processes and outcomes, I try to utilize different methodologies, and a plural methodological approach is something I advocate for. And in that sense, most of the time I use mixed methods research, because the processes are pretty much captured through qualitative approach, participant observation, qualitative interviews, and so on. And the outcome, actually, for official purposes, sometimes to communicate to enhance its policy relevance, it is also important to measure it quantitatively. What has changed and from where did it change, and so on. So these combinations of approaches, and in fact, to understand the real meaning of land itself, not just as a resource, but also as an anchor of identity and different social practices for the people, could be understood if we make sense of the power relations as people make decisions about these lands. And that is also why I apply political ecological approach in most of my research, and combination of actually political economy and ecological concerns. What is also important is to situate these local dynamics within broader structural forces that sometimes actually go beyond the border of the country itself. That is what makes these transnational land deals important in this case. That is all possibly very, very summarized manner of putting what could be learned from this.
Thank you. I mean, it's a really great like condensation, and I mean, so much in there. And I know that we're only just starting to scratch the surface of this. There's so much more we could dive into, but I know that it's getting a bit late, and we all probably need to get going. So the time has come for the question.
Oh my goodness, it's the question!
So, Gutu, at the end of every episode, to kind of has like a call to action for our listeners. You've given us so much here, and there's a lot of really like deep and powerful information, and very touching on a human level. But for our listeners at home, what can they do if they want to be able to make some sort of impact or a difference or learn more? What can you recommend to them to do?
Thank you, Chris. Now, possibly, if I had more time, we had more time, I could have actually talked about other topics. But let me bring in now this issue of engagement with real people and the question of scholarly activism that has recently started to attract my attention. It's only 6 years, probably, that I started to be very public in terms of my position on what matters to people. And in here, probably, it is fair to remember Martin Luther King, who said, "Our lives begin to end the day we become silent about things that matter." What is important is now the current state of affairs, when very critically looked at in terms of the process that people are living through in this kind of land lease, for example, and the outcome that happened to be a lot of burden on them compared to any benefit they may gain from the process. Now, the dissatisfaction with the status quo, with the current state of affairs, is something to begin with. It needs to be critiqued. The way things are being done should be revealed, exposed for people to see. And that all should be based on truthfulness and credible data. Once that is in place, the search for alternative, probably that is very important also in relation to the Exalt podcast, is that we root, actually, we place or we ground the search for alternative in the desirability for change. Change is desirable. But also, further search for alternative would also imply the need to see whether that thing which we aspire for is achievable, achievability. or what should be done to make it achievable, for real change to happen, for improvement to take place. And once it is achieved, how viable and sustainable would it be is another issue to think about. Now, for people, there are many ways of learning the implications, the real implications of land leases. And as far as my current work, people could contact me through email. I can give my email address, gutuolana@gmail.com, gutuolana@gmail.com, or gutuwayesa, gutu.wayesa@helsinki.fi. If anybody contacts me, I can share my articles or articles I co-authored with primarily with Anya Newgren so far. Some of the materials could be available on university portal of the University of Helsinki, TUHAT. There is a lot to explore in this field, and my research would continue expanding these topics in the future, with an aspiration, of course, to expand it even to other countries on a comparative scale. I'm pretty pleased to be here. Thank you very much for hosting me.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us. Listeners will make sure to link to those email addresses and also the university portal down in the show notes. And I highly encourage anybody who is interested in this topic to contact Gutu, because his papers are quite interesting. They get further into some of the things that we've talked about, and they are very, very approachable and readable. So like I said, if you're interested in this topic, you should definitely hit him up.
Yes, and thank you so much for coming on, Gutu. I know that we have so much more to talk about, and hopefully we can have you back on here sometime in the future. This has just been such a wonderful and fascinating, and I keep saying it, but powerful conversation.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here, and I'm willing to come back again.
Thank you again to Gutu Olenawayesa for joining us. Please join us next month when we'll be talking with University of Helsinki Professor Anya Newgren about lived experiences, alternatives, and different types of extractivisms. Coming to you from the fresh air and sunny skies of Helsinki, on behalf of Sofia Hagelani-Albov, I am Christopher Shagnon. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.